Tribune Tower, WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything within the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. Welcome to this edition of the Sunday Spin for August the 5th, 2018. Yes, the first Sunday in August. Welcome to our weekly look at the world of politics and policy as we take a look at City Hall, the State House, all the way out to the White House. Time to grab that Sunday paper, get that cup of coffee. We'll do our best to get your week off to a great start. Well, it's been quite a week in downtown Chicago. I'll tell you, Dave and Andy, I don't remember seeing as many tourists. The Lollapalooza is just bringing everybody into town.
They come from all directions, don't they?
Yes, they do. And appear to be rather directionless, too. The people with their... faces planted into their phones. I'm trying to be generous here and hoping that they're actually like looking at GPS for directions or something. But
maybe, yeah, let's put it that way. Perhaps they are.
I didn't realize the GPS coordinates were in the sky. That's where I saw a lot of people looking as they were walking down the streets yesterday.
And walking very slowly, I might add.
That's true, too.
It's
not only slowly, but then they'll stand.
Right.
They'll just stop.
Or stop. They'll just stop right in front of you.
And stand in the middle of the sidewalk, and you're moving, and people around you are moving. So I
really like the ones that are trying to take pictures on the Michigan Avenue Bridge during the afternoon rush.
And it's in the center of the bridge.
Yes, right. And I have to admit, first couple of times, I would stop. You can't stop because then the people behind you are running.
They have
into
to
you.
Stop.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. So stop it. Cut it out. You know? Keep moving. Nothing to see here. But
have you ever had anybody ask you to take their picture in the center of the Michigan Avenue Bridge?
No.
I have.
Have you?
Mm-hmm.
Do you?
It depends. If there's a lot of traffic on the bridge, I'll just keep walking, pretend like I didn't hear them. But if there's not a lot of traffic, I'll do it.
But there's always traffic on that
bridge.
Yeah,
it depends on what time of day, though.
Especially this weekend with everything going on.
Yeah, that is...
Saturdays and Sundays, I'm closed, yeah.
Yeah, it just... I mean, I was just kind of overwhelmed by the number of people. And, of course, you know, being on this side of the river now and over closer with Millennium Park, I mean, I always thought there was decent foot traffic on North Michigan Avenue on the north side of the river, but... There is a ton of foot traffic of people right around Millennium Park and obviously with Grant Park and Lala.
And if you are at the intersection of Randolph and Michigan during the week around 4 or 5 in the afternoon, be very patient.
Oh, yeah. The intersection, the sidewalks aren't designed for everybody, for that number of people. But how was Lala, Dave? I'm sure you were there. Right?
Oh, sure I was.
What was your favorite band?
Sam the Sham and the Pharaohs. I tried to see if they would do Wooly Bully. No, I heard a little bit of the music as I was. I had a busy day yesterday, so I really didn't have much of a chance to go by there. I can tell you the Red Line was quite busy yesterday.
I can
imagine. Coming into the city. And I've seen a lot of different costumes,
fashion statements,
outfits, fashion statements,
fashion faux pas.
You could put it that way. Fashion faux pas.
A lot of glitter.
Oh, you got that right. Yeah, a lot of glitter. Painted faces, you know.
Right.
And to be young again.
I would have liked to have seen Bruno Mars.
Mm-hmm. I like Bruno Mars.
And I saw the crowds that were lined up
for Bruno. Yeah,
to go through security. Which, I don't know, maybe looked like a typical day at Midway. yeah, I mean, just the tons of people. But, hey, a little inconvenience, but it's great for our revenue generating here in the city because we need it. We need all the money we can get.
I'm now going to keep track of how long it will take for cleanup. This being the last day, I start this countdown on Monday.
Well, but fortunately no rain.
No. Scattered storms, but nothing imminent that would, you know, if you remember a few years ago,
right.
They closed the festival, and that was, Michigan Avenue was chaotic as a result of that. Tens of thousands of people all running for shelter at the same time.
And what it took to repair the park.
Oh, yes, right. It was months before everything was back to normal, more or less. This is why I say I start this countdown to see how long it's going to take. And as we mentioned in our traffic report, the road closures won't be 100% down until well into the week now.
Yeah, that's what I figured. And you can tell from just the I mean, trying to go down Michigan Avenue, you might as well forget it for the most part. But, of course, people say, okay, then you go to State or Wabash or Dearborn, and it compounds everything.
There really is no good alternative.
The L.
Yeah.
The L. Really.
Yeah, is staying at home.
Yeah, well, staying at
there's
home.
There's the alternative.
If that option exists,
yes.
I would certainly have thought about that. So we got to see a little bit of the Bears this past week.
Mm-hmm. Very little.
Yeah, very little. But it was nice to see a little bit of football back.
Yeah, it's not too bad. You know, you kind of knew what to expect going into this one. This was more of the pomp and circumstance kind of a game,
right,
because Urlacher and Ray Lewis were going into the Hall of Fame, and it's the two teams that they played for, and not a single starter saw the field for either team.
Right. So, yeah, but it was fun.
Yeah, it was a little sloppy, but it was good.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't mind it. We had a nice day for Chicago baseball yesterday with the Cubs and the White Sox both taking a victory.
Yeah, a couple nice wins. Wrigley Field was jumping again yesterday with Kyle Schwarber hitting his 20th home run of the year. And Anthony Rizzo hit his 17th in that 5-4 win. And it was it's nice to see the White Sox put together a couple of wins in a row on the road. It's been a little bit of a difficult time for them on the road. A little small ball helped them yesterday. Leury Garcia lays down a bunt with two strikes, and Ricky Renteria said after the game that he was doing that on his own. He noticed the defense, and it ended up becoming the winning run because the third baseman rushed in and threw the ball away and allowed Tim Anderson to score, and it was a 2-1 win.
That's smart baseball.
Mm-hmm.
Take what the other team gives you and make the plays out of it.
Yeah, especially Garcia's fast. Larry Garcia can get down the line a little bit there, too, so it put a lot of pressure on Matt Duffy, their third baseman.
And the Cubs with, back-to-back 5-4 wins?
I think it's it might have been 5-4, 5-4, yeah. I know yesterday was definitely 5-4.
But you had games where the Cubs had it in the bag.
Yeah. The bullpen was good yesterday, even though the Padres came back a little bit. They have a couple of good hitters on that team, on the Padres team. And I think Anthony Rizzo said after the game yesterday that it's just one of these things where these teams from the West only come into Wrigley Field one time, and they stop at first base when they get on the base and say, "Hey, listen, this is a great place. You get to play here all the time. We love this." And I think the ballpark brings a little something out of some of these guys.
Oh, I'm sure of that. Because I mean, honestly, I don't know what the Padres' record is, and
it's not good.
I didn't think it was.
Mm-hmm.
But I was getting kind of frustrated with the Cubs. And, I mean, even yesterday, I think they had bases loaded, nobody out in the seventh inning. And that was the time to just break it open and got nothing out of it.
Yeah, why make it easy when you can make it interesting, right?
I don't need that kind of stress. I have enough stress during the rest of the week. And I believe Blackhawks preseason tickets go on sale tomorrow.
How about that, huh?
Yeah.
I think their first game is against the Red Wings, if that sounds right. I think
yes,
it does
I
sound
believe
right.
That is correct.
So that's always a fun one, even though the Red Wings are ducking the Blackhawks by moving to the East.
Yes, I've seen some of these preseason ratings of where teams place, and they're in the bottom five.
Which is okay.
Detroit.
Yeah.
I got no problem with that.
They've been kind of in rebuilding mode for the last 3 or 4 years.
Five.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm trying to be kind to our neighbors.
Why?
I don't know. Just because I'm in a charitable mood on Sunday.
We're talking the Red Wings.
Yeah.
Something I said.
I didn't know. They've been rebuilding for the last 10 years.
I didn't know there was anything charitable when it comes to
They're not even in the division anymore.
I know.
It's like they don't even exist.
Oh, they still exist. Yeah, they're original six.
Yes,
I'm
they
sorry.
Are. I hear you.
That kind of that dies very hard with me.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean hockey. This is I don't want summer to end.
No,
but,
me neither.
August is kind of that dead spot for hockey, and you can't wait for it to come back.
Yeah, pretty soon we'll have the end of the baseball season, the preseason in hockey, the NFL will be kicking off, college football will be back. We'll have a lot to do.
Yes, we will. Yes, we will. But that's all so fun.
Oh,
it's all going on at the same time.
There's preseason always. Bears coming up very quickly.
Yeah, the second game is coming up on Thursday. I think the starters will play a little bit more in that one. You got to see what Mitchell Trubisky has picked up in this brand new offense. So
it'd be nice.
Yeah,
it'd be nice to see. Well, all good things ahead. Dave's here to keep us up to date on all the news. Andy has the latest sports. Producer Kassira is here to field your phone calls. We're at 312-981-7200. You can text us at 312-981-7200. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin. And we're on Twitter at @SundaySpin. And engineer Bob is here to punch all of the buttons. Remember, you can find all our shows on WGNRadio.com. You can also get our podcast at iTunes by searching for my name, Rick Pearson. Up ahead, after the 7:30 news, we'll speak to Republican State Representative David McSweeney of Barrington Hills. He's an ardent foe of the graduated income tax that's backed by Democratic governor candidate J.B. Pritzker. He'll give us his rationale for that. We'll have more news and sports at 8, and then we'll speak to Democratic State Comptroller Susana Mendoza. She was behind legislation recently signed into law that prevents governors from shifting their staff's salaries onto other state agencies, and kind of a practice called offshoring that's been done for decades as Illinois chief executives try to show that they're being frugal in their own office with money by outsourcing the salaries to other state agencies. We'll get a final check of news and sports from Dave and Andy at 8:30, and then we'll speak to my Tribune colleague Bill Ruthart. Bill takes a look in today's paper about plans for the rejuvenated Riverwalk east of the Michigan Avenue Bridge. We'll also talk about the budding mayoral race, as well as the proposed consent decree involving the Chicago Police Department. That's all up ahead, but right now we're going to take a quick break. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, the Chicago Tribune, here in the Allstate Skyline Studio on Upper Wacker Drive, overlooking the Chicago River, Navy Pier, and a very calm Lake Michigan today. Time to kick off our weekly spin through national politics, and I'd like to begin with some audio from the White House press briefing room from last Thursday. That's when Sarah Huckabee Sanders, the White House press secretary, was asked by CNN's Jim Acosta to say that the media was not, repeat, not the enemy of the people, as the president has alleged. This is a lengthy audio cut, but I think it's important to hear all of it, and here's Jim Acosta asking his question.
I just wanted to follow up on Sarah's question from NPR. She asked you about Ivanka Trump's statement that the press is not the enemy of the people. And she asked you whether or not the press is the enemy of the people. You read off a laundry list of your concerns about the press and things that you feel like are misreported. But you did not say that the press is not the enemy of the people. And I think it would be a good thing if you were to say right here, at this briefing, that the press, the people who are gathered in this room right now, doing their jobs every day, asking questions of officials like the ones you brought forward earlier, are not the enemy of the people. I think we deserve that.
I think the president has made his position known. I also think it's ironic.
Would you mind telling us,
I'm trying to answer your question.
Okay,
I politely waited, and I even called on you despite the fact that you interrupted me while calling on your colleague. I said it's ironic.
Which is why I interrupted.
I'm trying.
But if you finish, if you would not mind letting me have a follow-up, that would be fine. But
it's ironic, Jim, that not only you and the media attack the president for his rhetoric when they frequently lower the level of conversation in this country. Repeatedly, the media resorts to personal attacks without any content other than to incite anger. The media has attacked me personally on a number of occasions, including your own network, said I should be harassed as a life sentence, that I should be choked. ICE officials are not welcomed in their place of worship, and personal information is shared on the internet. When I was hosted by the Correspondents Association, of which almost all of you are members of, you brought a comedian up to attack my appearance and call me a traitor to my own gender. In fact, as I know, I'm the first press secretary in the history of the United States that's required Secret Service protection. The media continues to ratchet up the verbal assault against the president and everyone in this administration, and certainly we have a role to play, but the media has a role to play for the discourse in this country as well.
And sir, if you don't mind, if I may follow up, excuse me, you did not say in the course of those remarks that you just made that the press is not the enemy of the people. Are we to take it from what you just said? We all get put through the ringer. We all get put in the meat grinder in this town, and you're no exception. And I'm sorry that that happened to you. I wish that that had not happened. But for the sake of this room, the people who are in this room, this democracy, this country, all the people around the world are watching what you're saying, Sarah, and the White House for the United States of America, the President of the United States, should not refer to us as the enemy of the people. His own daughter acknowledges that, and all I'm asking you to do, Sarah, is to acknowledge that right now and right here.
I appreciate your passion. I share it. I've addressed this question. I've addressed my personal feelings. I'm here to speak on behalf of the president. He's made his comments clear.
There you have it. I could never imagine a day when this would be the official position of the White House, speaking to a world about democracy and freedom and press freedom. But this is what this president is all about. In fact, at 6:39 a.m. this morning, he was on the Twitter, "The fake news hates me, saying that they are the enemy of the people only because they know it's true. I'm providing a great service by explaining this to the American people. They purposely cause great division and distrust. They can also cause war. They are very dangerous and sick." That's the morning news from the President of the United States of America. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's The Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Welcome back to The Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson. For months, we've heard from President Trump that there's no collusion with Russia, no collusion with Russia, no collusion with Russia. It's a mantra. But his lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, went on CNN and basically said, well, collusion wasn't a crime.
4 months, they're not going to be colluding about Russians, which I'm not even know if that's a crime, colluding about Russians.
Okay.
you start analyzing the crime. The hacking is the crime.
Certainly is the original.
Well, the president didn't hack.
Of course not. That's the original.
He didn't pay them for hacking.
And as you know, it has led other places. The meeting with the Russians.
If you got the hacked information from the Russians here at CNN and you played it, would you be in jeopardy of going to jail? Of course not.
So now there is the new legal theory. Meanwhile, the president, using his Twitter account, criticizing Attorney General Jeff Sessions, and said Sessions should shut down Robert Mueller's probe, even though Sessions recused himself from that issue. That prompted questions about obstruction. Sarah Huckabee Sanders was asked about it by those enemies of the people.
It's not an order. It's the president's opinion. And it's ridiculous that all of the corruption and dishonesty that's gone on with the launching of the witch hunt, the president has watched this process play out. But he also wants to see it come to an end, as he stated many times. And we look forward to that happening.
That's Sarah Huckabee Sanders speaking to the enemy of the people. Joining me now on the phone is State Representative David McSweeney, Republican from Barrington Hills. Representative, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Rick, thanks for having me on. And I was just reminded that Urlacher was that ninth draft pick, as they said on your newscast. Best draft pick for the Bears ever. Maybe Walter Payton was better, but a great pick.
Certainly a great pick and a great honor to have him in the Hall of Fame. And very emblematic of what the Bears used to be, especially in that middle linebacker spot, that's for sure. I wanted to have you on to talk about the issue of a graduated income tax. And you have been pretty consistent in your Twitter feeds about your opposition to it and your belief that that would be just really tantamount to a tax increase on most people. Can you tell me a little bit about the rationale behind your thinking on this?
Sure. The progressive income tax is really just a code phrase for a massive tax increase. We see what's happening in California and Minnesota. Those are states that progressives say that they want to emulate, and they have much higher rates. We have the highest tax burden in the country in Illinois when you combine the income tax, property tax burden, and the sales tax burden. And if you actually increase the income tax rate further, we're going to lose people. We're going to lose two congressional seats, as it appears now. We're lost 33,000 net population. We're behind Pennsylvania now in population to be the sixth most populous state. And I believe that raising taxes will actually kill jobs. We have great natural resources. We have great people. Chicago is the best city in the world. The issue is that we have terrible policies, and we have pension liabilities that are about $250 billion if you look at a correct methodology, and we have Medicaid spending is out of control. So we need to control spending, and my belief is that a progressive income tax system would be very harmful to the state in the long term.
But if, as some have suggested, if you were to have this graduated income tax structure, that you could, in essence, maybe offset some of the heavy burden that are placed on homeowners for property taxes, particularly for schools, kind of creating that kind of tax shift, as it were, wouldn't that kind of perhaps maybe remove some of those concerns about people moving out of state if their property taxes weren't as high?
Well, I have no doubt that it would be a net tax increase. In fact, you look at the precedent in the other states, and the problem is that once you adopt a progressive income tax system, the rates can be changed by the General Assembly at any point. And I certainly don't trust the Illinois General Assembly to set rates under a progressive system. So I don't believe there ever would be tax relief. I mean, you look at states around us with a progressive income tax, and the rates are higher. The problem is that you combine higher rates in Illinois under a progressive system with our high property taxes and high sales tax, and I think it would be very, very detrimental to the state. We need to reform pensions and Medicaid. That's where the money is.
Well, but what if taking aside even the issue of a graduated income tax, even if you just raised Illinois' flat tax to shift some of the burden off of those property taxes, wouldn't that be a fairer method of taxation?
I don't think so. In fact, what it would do, in my view, is we would end up with a net increase. As you know, under Jim Edgar and others, there was this attempt to talk about raising the income tax and allegedly cutting property taxes. What I think we need to do is cut income taxes and cut property taxes. I have a bill that would force a 10% reduction in the tax levy by imposing what they call the PTEL, the property tax limitation factor, on all units of government, including home rule units of government. I think it's better to cut property taxes and cut income taxes. And again, that really means that you have to address pensions and Medicaid. That's the only way to address that at the state level, and of course, pensions at the local level.
But are we really in a position that we can cut taxes given the financial debt load that we face?
Let's talk about pensions. That's where a lot of the money is. Number one, we need a constitutional amendment like Arizona. Arizona is a very similar constitution. You create an enforceable contract with pensions. They were able to do a negotiated settlement. That's why you need a governor who will actually negotiate with the unions. And they actually codified a law that changed the annual benefit increases into the constitution. I mean, the issue we have right now, Rick, as you know, is that benefits are growing at 3% compounded per year. Inflation is only 1.5%. That's driving that liability up. For new employees, we need a real 401k system, and you and me have had this conversation for years, and it's totally constitutional. As part of that whole process, we need to restructure that pension debt. We're on an arbitrary schedule based on a 1995 law that was passed. And then on Medicaid, we need to do a much better job of getting our fair share of federal money. We have one of the lowest federal matching percentages in the country at 50%. We need to complete the private audit of the Medicaid system. And we also need to go for waivers and tighten up eligibility. We need a work requirement for able-bodied people, and we also need to make sure we're taking care of the truly needy. But 25% of the people in the state of Illinois are now receiving Medicaid benefits, so we need to tighten up the eligibility to make sure that we're only using Medicaid for the truly needy, in my view.
Why aren't we capturing a greater share of return from the federal government?
Well, two reasons. One, you would need a change in federal law. It goes back what they call the FMAP provision, which sets the reimbursement rate. Most of the states in the Midwest are receiving over 60% of the Medicaid costs from the federal government. We're receiving 50%. We have two senators who claim that they want to bring back money to Illinois. That would be a way to do it. And our Republican delegation, I know, has been trying to do that. And we have a Republican president. So that's one way of doing it at the federal level. But the other way of doing it is to be innovative. I've discussed this with you many times, too. I have a very good relationship with Greg Harris. Greg and I disagree on a number of issues, but we work together, as I work together with others like Susanna Mendoza, who you're going to have on the show, when it's the right thing to do. And he has some innovative ideas and ways to change state law to bring in more federal dollars. But we also need to pursue waivers. We have a Republican administration, and that means that this governor should be talking to the President of the United States about ways to bring in more federal dollars, ways to reform the Medicaid system, and simply he hasn't been doing that. You've written about one day he likes Trump, the next day he doesn't, so I'm not sure where he stands these days.
Wouldn't that hold true beyond Medicaid? I mean, as far as getting more federal dollars for various state programs?
Well, absolutely, but I think Medicaid is the biggest one. As you know, if you look at the budget, the pensions and Medicaid really drive. They're both about $7.5 billion each, so $15 billion out of a $37 billion budget. That's where the money is. But, you know, on the pensions, too, if you had a negotiated settlement with the unions, you could address the health care benefits, the unfunded liability that we have for group health insurance, in addition to the overall contractual issues that are out there, too. So it definitely, in my view, on pensions, there needs to be a negotiated settlement and then codify it with a constitutional amendment. But overall, 100% we need to address Medicaid and pensions. That's a much better alternative than raising taxes.
We're speaking with Republican State Representative David McSweeney from Barrington Hills. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, speaking to Republican State Representative David McSweeney from Barrington Hills, talking about some of the fiscal issues involving the state, as well as the calls by Democratic Governor candidate J.B. Pritzker for a graduated income tax. Representative, right before the break, you were talking about, as far as pensions, a negotiated settlement with the unions. Why should the unions want to come to the table, given that, you know, it's been pretty explicit on how the court has ruled involving the guarantees that exist under the Constitution?
Well, that's why I think it has to be a global solution, and that's around the AFSCME contract, group health insurance benefits, and pension liabilities. And I think when you talk to union members, they realize that it is not sustainable to have a 3% compounded growth in benefits every year. It's not a cost of living. It's actually an increase in benefits every year. So it has to be, in my view, a global solution. And that's what they did in Arizona. And in Arizona, the unions realized that they could not allow the pension system basically to become insolvent. And that's where we're heading in the state of Illinois. But it can't just be on pensions. I don't think it has to be also be on group health insurance benefits, on work rules, on wages, on benefits. And I think having that type of global solution is key in the future. And that's why, you know, it's very important, I think, to maintain a dialogue with all sides. And you know, we're in a political environment in Illinois and at the national level, and everybody just pounds the table. What you have to do is roll up your sleeves and do the hard work. And I believe that ultimately a negotiated settlement and a constitutional amendment that codifies a reduction in the benefit increases every year is the best solution.
So basically a grand convening of everybody together on this.
I think you have to. That's the only way you're going to get the three-fifths vote for a constitutional amendment in, you know, the foreseeable future in Illinois. And then I believe that would be approved by the citizens of the state of Illinois because they know this tax burden is too high. But I do believe that there has to be a global settlement, and if the unions are not willing to negotiate, then certainly you would have to move aggressively on other issues. You just can't look at pensions alone. You've got to look at everything as a package, and I think that's the best way to strike an overall deal when you include the group health insurance benefits, but also include wages, benefits, and pay. It has to be part of a global solution. That's the best deal for taxpayers, I believe.
What about as far as the pension ramp payments?
Well, that's what I was referring to, that as part of a global settlement, I think you have to restructure those payments. And we're paying $7.5 billion into a broken system. If you're able to change the benefit increases going forward to reduce those, if you're able to go to a 401k system, those would be very important for the rating agencies. And I think you could then look at renegotiating or restructuring, more accurately, the pension ramp. You remember, that was 1995. That was an arbitrary schedule. And right now you have a system that allegedly we're going to get to 90% funding by 2045. You get up to about $13 billion a year, which obviously will put more pressure on the budget. And then allegedly in 2046, you don't have to put anything into the system. That doesn't make any sense. You've got to restructure the pension debt, but you cannot do that alone. You have to do that with a global solution, as I was talking about.
You mentioned earlier about working with Greg Harris, and this again on this topic of Medicaid, and I know that you are co-sponsoring legislation with him in regards to part of this, the governor's restructuring of the Medicaid program and trying to protect, I guess it would be medical equipment and things that Medicaid recipients now receive, making sure that they're entitled to those in the future. Could you kind of explain that better than I can, please?
Oh, no problem. But what happened last year is the administration in Illinois decided that they would exempt the procurement process for managed care organizations from the procurement quote. I think that was a mistake. Other governors have done that, so that's not the best deal for taxpayers. I have seen zero evidence. I have asked for it multiple times that it's going to save any money. The governor claims it's going to save money over time to move a lot more people into managed care organizations and to have less managed care companies covering us. No proof at all has been presented that's going to save money. One of the things the insurance companies are doing is they're slashing the reimbursement rate to medical suppliers, and all that's doing is driving medical suppliers out of business, and we're ending up with monopolies, in my view, in the long term, which will cost the taxpayers more money. So we have a bill that would prohibit sole source contracts by these managed care organizations for medical supplies, and it would also require a 90% reimbursement rate. This would not cost the taxpayers of the state any money because the money is being paid to these managed care organizations. I think they're making the money right now. And because this didn't go through a full procurement process, the insurance companies are benefiting. We're just trying to make sure long-term they're protecting the taxpayers of the state.
There seem to be some real concerns about these managed care organizations and that, you know, even when it comes down to some of the providers to them, you know, they're controlling a process that, you know, used to be kind of a state controlled process, and questions abound about the ability of these managed care organizations. Are they in it for the money?
And that's my concern, is there's no transparency. Again, I want to be very clear. They decided to exempt the entire process, the largest procurement in the history of the state of Illinois. They exempted from the procurement code. That's never good. And again, this is not the only administration that has done that, but we're in the dark on exactly what's going on. And my concern is that the insurance companies are making a fortune at the expense of taxpayers long term, because as we drive medical suppliers, we drive physicians out of the Medicaid system, all that's going to do is lead to higher prices in the future. And that's why Greg Harris and I worked together on that legislation. And I know you're going to have Comptroller Mendoza We have disagreements on a number of issues, for example, the progressive tax. But we worked together on this recent outsourcing bill to make sure there's proper accounting for the governor's budget. We worked on the Debt Transparency Act. We have a bill to make sure that the late payment interest penalties are properly projected and accounted for. So, you know, it's key, I believe, in this state. There's too much rhetoric and name-calling and these TV ads, you know, back and forth. You can have different disagreements with people, but then you can work together and try to do what's best for the people of the state of Illinois.
But has, I mean, you've cited some examples, and that's all very fair, but just have politics just become too polarized in this state?
In a lot of ways, it has, because we, you know, have a couple of billionaires, you know, who are up on TV every day calling each other names. It's, you know, it's childish. I mean, what I would love to see is a debate on the issues we talked about today, a real debate on pensions, a real debate on Medicaid, a real debate on taxes. But I'm not seeing that when I turn on my TV. I watch very little TV. I do a lot of reading, but I watch the Cubs game, and every time I turn on that Cubs game, I see at least 10 ads on both sides, and it's really got to the point of being disgusting. But you know what? We still have 3 months more of that.
We have a lot more to go, and tens of millions of dollars in TV advertising to go along as well. But at least now we know J.B. Pritzker likes puppies.
Yeah, I mean, this whole thing has just gotten to the point of just being, you know, absolutely just ridiculous. Toilet seats, puppies, the whole thing. Well, why don't we have a real debate on these issues? I mean it. I mean, why don't we? People can have disagreements, but this is really the future of the state. And we have, again, great people, great infrastructure, great city. What we need is better policies, and I would like to see a full real debate on these issues going forward. I think that would serve the people a lot better. But, you know, having the billionaires back and forth calling each other names, toilet names, and talking about puppies, it's an insult to the people of the state.
That's Republican State Representative David McSweeney from Barrington Hills. Representative, thank you as always.
And, Rick, you are not an enemy of the people.
I'll wear that as a badge of honor today. Thank you very much, Representative.
Thank you.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome to the second hour of your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. Just how Republicans deal with Trump in these midterms is kind of an issue that we're watching play out across the country. We've seen here in Illinois how Governor Rauner tries to step closer, but then not too close, or then maybe step away from the White House. But in Florida, Republican governor candidate Ron DeSantis, well, he's all in with an ad featuring his wife, Casey, and daughter, Madison.
Everyone knows my husband, Ron DeSantis, is endorsed by President Trump, but he's also an amazing dad. Ron loves playing with the kids.
Build the wall.
He reads stories.
Then Mr. Trump said, "You're fired." I love that part.
He's teaching Madison to talk.
Make America great again.
People say Ron's all Trump, but he is so much more.
Big league. So good.
I just thought you should know.
Ron DeSantis for governor.
And that's how the Republican campaign is playing out for governor in Florida. Well, joining me now here in the Allstate Skyline studio is Susana Mendoza. She is the Democratic Comptroller for the state of Illinois. Madam Comptroller, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you. I think I was busy puking there. Sorry. Oh, my God. I seriously feel sick after hearing that.
It is interesting to see how some of these campaigns play out around the country.
How about, I don't even feel comfortable having the TV set on with my five-year-old in the house. I'm not kidding. It is, like, not something I want him to see or traits I want him to learn to emulate.
Well, you know, it's especially when you have wealthy candidates. And, I mean, let's face it, I remember I talked to one political scientist, and was asking them about some strategy that a candidate was using. And they said, well, if it was a regular funded candidate, you'd say, well, they're probably wasting money. Except when people have so much money, if it means switching one vote, is it a waste?
Right.
That's kind of the nature of our politics today. Well, I wanted to ask you about the Truth in Hiring Act. And I was trying to explain, this is something that we've seen from both parties for decades of governors trying to, we call it offshoring now, I guess that's the, mm-hmm. the term that works, but basically really hiding the costs of high staffers and attributing them to various state agencies, like
right.
the Department of Transportation or Health and Family Services, those kinds of things. And then you present your budget and you say, oh, well, look, I'm saving all this money from what my predecessor had, when in actuality, that's how, I mean, Pat Quinn was offshored.
He was
in the Dan Walker administration.
That's right, under Dan Walker.
Mm-hmm. He was in the Illinois Industrial Commission.
Mm-hmm. So, and he was a chronic offender of this deceptive practice when he was governor.
Yes.
So,
but the governor didn't necessarily want to sign this bill.
He did not necessarily. He did not want to sign this bill, but, you know, I'm glad he did. I think it was pretty evident that this bill had garnered widespread bipartisan support. As a matter of fact, it passed through the House of Representatives unanimously. And in the Senate, I think there were only like 7 people that voted against it. So we would have, if he had not signed it, it would have become law on its own. But that would have been the first time in his tenure that he let something become law on its own without signing it, right? So
right,
he was
without
kind of
taking
this,
action.
Yes,
on
he
it.
Was like in a pickle here. Does my bill become the first bill during his tenure to become law without his signature, right? Which would have been a whole different story.
Right.
Or does he veto it and then get overwhelmingly, hopefully unanimously, overridden on a veto like we did with the Debt Transparency Act? So I think he had people advising him to do the right thing, and I'm glad he did, and that we now have this practice come to an end here in Illinois, and future governors will not be able to continue to hide their true cost of their payroll from the public. I mean, taxpayers deserve to know how their money's being spent. And when governors present budgets, they should be honest budgets. And that goes for every other state constitutional officer. I mean, the governor kind of threw out this like fake example that, well, this should apply to all the other constitutional officers. But that's kind of like saying you're going to ticket, you're going to give people speeding tickets for jaywalking, right? Like the two don't go together. The other state constitutional officers do not do offshoring. And where there are intergovernmental agreements, they're on these levels which are equal. So, for example, if this attorney general wants to have lawyers that are being paid out of revenue, that's because they went into an intergovernmental agreement with the Department of Revenue, which is on equal footing. But when the governor, for example, takes employees, takes the payroll out of other employee agencies that he controls, that's like saying if he's your boss, Rick, that, hey, I'm going to take $150,000 out of your budget, and I hope you don't mind. But even if you do mind, there's absolutely nothing you can do because he's your boss, right? So the power dynamic and the power shift is not equal.
And this is one of several transparency bills that
yes.
you raised, and you mentioned, you touched on the debt transparency.
Which he did veto, and,
right.
you know, we
well, I was going to say,
do
you think that was
there.
A precursor for him to sign this was the fact
yes, that he's already been through that, right? So, and that was such a monumental, it was really revolutionary bill when you think about budgeting in Illinois. And for the first time in the history of the state of Illinois this year, when they were crafting budgets, the legislature was working off of numbers that were current as of a month earlier versus a year earlier, which used to be the status quo prior to the Debt Transparency Act. So why anyone in the right mind would veto a bill that would allow legislators, the public, and certainly the person responsible for managing the state's bills to be able to have visibility of those bills is crazy, but he did. And thankfully, the legislature, in unanimous fashion in the House, which, by the way, had never happened in the history of the state of Illinois, managed to override a governor's veto unanimously. So this is a good thing. Transparency is a hallmark of my administration. The governor and his address when he signed this in his statement said that transparency is a hallmark of his administration, but I think that would certainly, just based on the facts, only make sense on opposite day.
Well, the debt transparency, I thought, was a pretty significant only because everybody was basically doing guesstimates.
Right.
No one had actually any, only the agencies themselves knew how much their billing was that they were withholding from supplying to you for payment.
Yeah, to the controller's office, right.
And forcing the General Assembly, forcing comptrollers to try to do cash flow without knowing what next avalanche of bills is going to come
falling
out of
like
their head.
In the blind, it doesn't make any sense. And so, I mean, when I was in the legislature, I, along with all of my colleagues, we just assumed that the state's chief fiscal officer could see all of the liabilities that the state had incurred. And it wasn't until I took office as controller that I realized that that was far from the truth. And I could essentially, in any given day, maybe see half of all the liabilities, but I had to fly blind on everything else.
But you didn't know it was half.
I didn't even know it was half. Exactly. Now I know it was half based on the fact that we do have monthly reporting now with the Debt Transparency Act. But you're right. I was essentially flying blind that first, you know, year plus. And that's unacceptable. And it's not about me. It's about me doing the job that the taxpayers voted for me to do, which is to manage the state's fiscal accounts. And it's about taxpayers being able to know and have full faith and confidence as to how their money is being spent. And so this is what we're trying to do every day, is come up with initiatives that shine greater transparency on the state's finances. Because, as you know, there's a lot of things that have been happening that should not have been happening with the state's finances. And I believe that in order to clean it up, you have to shine some light on it. Because, as they say, sunshine or sunlight is a great disinfectant, right?
We're speaking with Susana Mendoza. She is the Democratic State Comptroller for the state of Illinois. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, here in the Allstate Skyline studio with Democratic State Comptroller Susana Mendoza. We're talking about transparency legislation, and we're talking about the bill to prevent the offshoring of salaries in the governor's office. But there's actually a couple of bills that are still pending out there on the governor's desk.
Yeah, we're hoping he will sign those as well. So I'll tell you really quickly what they do. I have two more to go. We have the budgeting for interest payment, which you can call the Mendoza McSweeney bill. So okay. Shout out to my pal Dave McSweeney. He was actually...
Maybe you guys should have just done the show today.
I know, right? And, that would have been fun. Yeah. He was actually the chief sponsor of the legislation in the House. And I don't know that you could ever point to a Democratic... constitutional officer of any, you know, office who's actually sought out a Republican or a member of the opposite party to be the lead sponsor on a bill. But I'm really committed to working in a bipartisan fashion, and he did a wonderful job. He's known to be a fiscal hawk. And so Dave sponsored that for me in the House. It passed unanimously. And what it does is that it requires governors to include in their budget proposals their plans to pay down the state's late payment interest penalties. And many times people have heard me talk about this. Those penalties now total nearly $1 billion. And that's only because I've paid some of them down, by the way. Right. They've gone over $1 billion just in late payment interest penalties. So up to now, governors have had to make no mention, or actually they've made no mention of these liabilities in their budget proposals. But moving forward, they will have to account for them in their budgets, and they'll have to have a plan for paying them down. These are real liabilities that have been incurred.
Well, it's like you can't just, because it's not on the book,
exactly.
Doesn't mean it doesn't exist.
I keep telling people, just because, you know, you're not talking about it doesn't mean it didn't happen. And so we have to pay these bills down. They're liabilities that taxpayers are on the hook for. And it's time that governors stop pretending that they didn't rack up these fees. Secondly, we have the vendor payment program transparency bill. And that would bring sunshine to the governor's program that allows lenders to upfront money to state vendors who are owed money by the state. So especially during the budget crisis, you know, a lot of
these third party.
Yeah, the vendors themselves weren't getting paid for the services that they rendered the state. And because we weren't paying them as a state since there was no budget, they were allowed to utilize third-party lenders. But we don't know anything about who these third-party lenders are. And now we're talking about a program that is upwards of $1 billion. So it's time to shine some light on who's behind all of these deals. Like, who is the money flowing to? I think that people deserve to know. And there should be some serious requirements in terms of transparency as to who's profiting from essentially the state's dysfunction, right? So
these were like vendors that were selling their accounts receivables.
So the 12% late payment interest penalties that the actual vendors are eligible for, that is what is contracted out to the third-party lenders. So they stand to make over $1 billion in late payment interest penalties. But again, we don't know who it's going to.
Right.
We know that it was money that was originally owed to a legitimate vendor that contracted with the state.
And provided
services. But then they contracted with this third-party lender of whom we know almost nothing about. So I think it's important, again, to follow the money and just to be transparent about where taxpayer dollars are going to. So those bills also almost unanimously passed both chambers and are awaiting the governor's signature.
Where do we stand on our payment backlog these days?
Well, I think just today we might be around $7.3 billion. Remember, we were at $16.7 billion about a year ago. So I'm very excited that we've been able to, through smart money management and also really leading the charge on refinancing the state's backlog. If you recall, Rick, we put out $6 billion worth of bonds to pay down that $16.7 billion, and we were able to refinance $6 billion of that at 3.5% instead of the 12% that we were paying. So that saved taxpayers $4 to $6 billion. And today, actually, I just looked up the number, and it's $7.6 billion. And it fluctuates anywhere between 6.5 to 8.5, just based on what payments I have to make. Like if I'm putting education payments out, you're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars.
Yeah, out,
right? Medicaid payments. I have to kind of wait to accrue the money that I need to make a big, huge payment. But essentially, that bill backlog is staying somewhat steady. The only difference to that is that now that we have a budget in place, you might remember that the governor and the legislature had to include a supplemental appropriation for Department of Corrections. Right. That was almost $500 million. Just because they appropriated doesn't mean that they have the revenues to pay for those. So the bill backlog will likely be going up, you know, anywhere from probably $800 million to $1 billion because of additional appropriations that the legislature and the governor approved without new revenue streams to pay for them. But I have it under control, and we're making sure that we continue to manage through this fiscal crisis as best as humanly possible.
Was this some of that spending that was questionably off the books?
Yeah, you bet it is. You bet it is. Absolutely. That $500 million, we didn't know about it until we had the Debt Transparency Act, right? So the governor had been essentially hiding the actual expenditures that his agencies made from the public. And if we didn't have this monthly reporting, we wouldn't even know about it until next October. Think about that.
Very timely.
Yes.
I wanted to switch gears a little bit. Are involved with this panel involving the Democratic Party, women of the Democratic Party, kind of trying to find a course forward aftermath of Me Too and issues within the party structure itself. And I know that there were some hearings that were scheduled, those kinds of things. I'm sorry, I haven't caught up on it.
No worries.
But I'm just wondering, where do things stand on that topic?
Sure. So I don't remember if I told you, because when we first talked about it, it was like so early on in the stages, but we actually set up as an independent 501c4.
Because part of the problem early on was who could be on it.
Because of Sherry Bustos, federal laws and blah, blah, blah. So essentially, we wanted to have a firewall between the Democratic Party of Illinois and the work of the panel. And in order to ensure we could do that, we went the 501c4 route and then made it a nonpartisan attempt at addressing the issues of sexual harassment in the political workspace, as well as what can we do as parties, regardless of what party you're in, right, to elevate women within the party structure. And so those are the two issues that the panel from the very beginning was charged with working on. And we've had six listening sessions throughout the entire state of Illinois. We were obviously here in Chicago. We were in Springfield. We were in Edwardsville. We were in Carbondale. We were in Rockford and in Champaign-Urbana. So we did six sessions. They were really well attended. We had Democrats and Republican women come out and share their stories with us and their recommendations for how to improve the issue of, you know, tackling sexual harassment, making sure that women feel safe and supported in their workspace, and knowing that there could be, or what would be a better way of allowing them to report an instance that happens, feeling that they're allegation or their complaint would be taken seriously and dealt with legitimately. And then also the issue of not enough women being in elected office, and how do we break down some of the barriers and the obstacles to entry. And one of the cool things that came out of it was this real passion now for like making Illinois the first state in the country. Rick, you'd never heard this probably till right now. I've said it maybe three times publicly now, but you got to see it in order to make it happen, right? And I really want to make, and my colleagues do as well. Illinois, the first state in the country to flip female majority in the legislature. Because let me tell you something. Everything that we're talking about, whether it's sexual harassment or how do you elevate women in the parties, et cetera, isn't really going to fundamentally change until we change the power structure that exists today. And when Illinois has 35% of all of its legislature female, I don't think that's a high enough number. We make up over 50% of the population. And while 35 may sound like a good number, it does make us the sixth highest state in terms of women. Did you know that?
I did not.
Yep, we're ranked sixth best, actually. But that has happened in large part organically because women decided to take on the party right. structure and eventually make their way there. I mean, I ran against the speaker's candidate twice before I got elected. Right. Carol Ammons ran against the DPI candidate before she got elected. Same with Melinda Bush, who's on our panel as a senator. She took on her party and, you know, kind of forced her way into the system. And so a lot of us got there by working against the party. Once we're there, the parties, both Republican and Democratic parties, I think do a really good job of supporting their female elected officials. But if you can get to 35% organically, imagine where we could be in just a few short years if the parties were to intentionally elevate women every opportunity that they had. So, for example, Christine Rodonio, highest ranking Republican right. in the Senate chamber, she resigns and then her appointed Senate seat automatically goes to a man. Maybe he's a wonderful guy. I don't know. But I have a hard time believing that the party, if they tried, couldn't find a wonderfully qualified and competent female to take her place. And so I'd like to see the parties start to think in a deliberative way in terms of elevating women. And when we make up a majority of the legislature, which nobody should be offended by the way, I mean, every single legislature in the state has a majority male structure. And so it would be nice to try to see what would happen in a state where the majority of those seats are held by women. And I think a lot of things would be fundamentally changed. It would significantly be a game changer.
We'll keep an eye on that. And of course, this is nationally a big year for
huge
for women candidates.
Well, I don't think we don't have the ability to go 51% right now if every single woman in the state that was running won, but Nevada does. So Nevada is in a position right now. They're at 38% female, and if every single woman in their space that's running for office, Democratic and Republican, won their elections, they would be the first state to go 51. They're not going to do it. It's like impossible that every woman will win that every single seat. But again, it's all happened organically. Illinois, I'm putting it out there. We're going to be the first state to make this happen, and it's super exciting.
That's Democratic State Comptroller Susana Mendoza. Madam Comptroller, thank you so much for joining me this
Thanks
morning.
For having me.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. The issue of separated migrant families continues. Illinois senior U.S. Senator Democrat Dick Durbin went to the Senate floor last week and called for Kirstjen Nielsen, the Homeland Security Secretary, to step down.
Incredibly, Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen claimed, and I quote, "We do not have a policy of separating families at the border, period." But it was on her watch and under her leadership that nearly 2,700 children were separated from their parents, and more than 700 children still have not been reunited with their families, including more than 400 whose parents were apparently deported and more than 90 whose parents can't be located at all. What will become of these children and their parents? Who border agents sadly called, quote, deleted family units. In the name of these deleted family units, 711 lost children, and common decency, I am today calling on the architect of this humanitarian disaster, Department of Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen, to step down.
That's U.S. Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois. We're going to switch gears here, talk about local politics, city politics, with Bill Ruthart, my Tribune colleague, a member of the Tribune's political team, who's been a bit busy lately for the dog days of summer.
Yeah, there is no slow season anymore, I don't think, these days. Not when there's 10 people challenging Rahm Emanuel for mayor. So,
well, let's start with the mayor and the news that the mayor is making about this redevelopment of the Riverwalk east of, I guess, is it Michigan Avenue?
Yeah, State Street, Michigan Avenue. Yeah, so anybody who follows the mayor closely like I do knows that the Riverwalk is...
That's his bright, shiny object.
He loves the Riverwalk. It's his pet project, and he, several years ago, got a nearly $100 million loan, interest-free, from the federal government during the Obama administration to build those brand new sections, basically west of State Street all the way down near Wolf Point. Those are the areas probably most people think about when they think about the Riverwalk. They built actually into the channel. Those right. walkways are right down by the water. But there's this stretch east of State Street, from State Street to Lakeshore Drive, basically, that's much older. Much of it dating to the early 1970s, and a couple sections of that was done in the 90s, the Vietnam Veterans Memorial. But basically, everything from Michigan Avenue to Lakeshore Drive is older, kind of you know, asphalt dirt path type. The businesses there aren't as kind of formal, and they're kind of running out of trailers and
pop-up
type stuff. So the mayor wants to spend $10 million to kind of refurbish that eastern stretch of the Riverwalk so it blends in more with the new, shinier western end that has bars, restaurants, city winery, Tiny Tap. There's some cafes down there that all have done, you know, booming business. The mayor in my interview with him for this story said that City Winery did $1 million in business for July alone down there on the Riverwalk, which was a new record. So, they want to carry that kind of, same. They use the word palette. They want it to look similar. They don't want this big disconnect between the old and the new. So, the city's going to spend $10 million on it, new landscaping, a lot of planters going in. Four businesses along that stretch will be putting in somewhere around $3 million to do their sections of the Riverwalk to build restaurants down there. Some of those businesses are there already, but they'll have much nicer, newer facilities, well, and some possibly permanent. Even year-round.
Yeah. Yeah, and I was curious about that aspect of it because I think that's, you know, when we look at those numbers, which are huge numbers, like for City Winery, just the seasonal nature of the business tells you, you know, how popular it is. But now when you look at some of what these businesses are talking about, year-round business, which is kind of an intriguing idea.
Right. And I think some of it has actually started with City Winery. They have these, I don't know if anybody walks down Wacker Drive in the winter, they're probably looking at their shoes and not trying to stay warm. But City Winery puts these basically bubbles down there, and right. there's these tables that are enclosed them, and so they're heated, and you can sit out there and even in the winter. And so yeah, there's the Island Party Huts, a business that's down on this older stretch of the Riverwalk, that currently is kind of, you know, a wooden stand with string lights in the trees down there, but they're talking about building a basically a glass enclosed restaurant with a retractable roof, and all the doors would open. So conceivably, you know, for St. Patrick's Day, or even just, and if they have the demand in the winter when it's, you could sit down there while it's snowing and belly up to the bar.
Watch a Bears game on a snowy Sunday.
Yeah. So that's the concept. They're going to probably rip out a lot of the trees that are down there to realign the path. And so some people are a little heartburn about that, just because it is, does really have a different feel down there. It's more of a park like setting. And I think some people, one of the, business owners down there said they don't want to see the park aspect go away too much. There's plenty of concrete, he said, on the other end of the Riverwalk. But certainly to allow room for some of these businesses to grow, some changes are going to have to be made. One of the things that also is going to change is that path that's down there is going to be located much closer to the water. Currently, it's kind of closer to Wacker Drive, which right. isn't that desirable. And there's also going to be a lot of effort done to mask Wacker Drive, either with landscaping or public art, that kind of thing. And so a lot of this is still conceptual. A glass elevator will be put in, which there is no elevator down the Riverwalk currently, so that's a big thing in terms of accessibility. And the Vista Tower that's under construction, the developers of that have to pay for that elevator, as well as a walkway that will go under Wacker Drive, connecting the Vista Tower and Lakeshore East neighborhood, which is basically where we are right now,
right,
to the Riverwalk.
Now, $10 million, where's the money coming from? And as much as the mayor likes to talk about the Riverwalk, how is this playing with some of the other opponents out there?
Well, so the $10 million is a two-year project, 2019 and 2020, and it'll come out of the city's capital budget. $10 million in the grand scheme of the city budget is a very, very small amount of money. However, you know, Emmanuel has faced all kinds of criticism.
Well, I was gonna say, given the climate,
for not doing enough to uplift economically challenged neighborhoods on the south and west sides. The mayor has a number of policies that he points to counter that he is doing that. That's a whole other discussion.
Yes.
You know, yeah, you're certainly going to see some activists, perhaps some mayoral candidates, I'm not sure we've heard a ton of it yet, say, hey, you know, we already have a Riverwalk. Let's put this $10 million somewhere else that can be put to better use. Mayor counters that this is a major attraction that's outdone our wildest imaginations in terms of popularity. We should continue to invest in it, continue to draw people down there. The revenue that generated by those businesses, a good cut of it, some of these contracts up to 10%, goes to the city, which goes to paying back that federal loan. And Emmanuel said that he's working with the staff to punch some numbers on some even more expensive additions to the Riverwalk, perhaps similar to the other end where the path will be built in closer to the water or into the seawall. And they may approach the Trump administration about another loan or a refinancing of their current loan. So we'll see how that goes.
That'll be interesting. We're speaking with Bill Ruthart, my Tribune colleague and part of the Tribune political team. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, joined by my Tribune colleague Bill Ruthart. We're talking over some issues involving the mayor and, of course, moving into issues involving the mayoral race. And on that subject, we've got Ron on the line. Ron, as always, welcome to the Sunday Spin.
Yeah, good morning, Rick. Real question. I know the last thing we probably need is another candidate to enter the race, but I wanted to ask you, is that a possibility? I know it's the summertime. People are not following politics as much. Just doesn't seem that these candidates really getting too much traction. It doesn't seem to be that much interest. So is it a possibility that we may see another more organized candidate, you know, who has more money backing? So, okay, thanks, guys.
Thanks, Ron.
Ron, good to talk to you again. It's always possible. However, you know, a lot of folks have gotten in the race earlier this time than 4 years ago. 4 years ago, you might remember, this time of year, the rumors of Karen Lewis running for mayor had barely started, and by October she had been diagnosed with brain cancer, and that's when Jesus Chuy Garcia jumped in. This time we've got former Chicago Police Board President Lori Lightfoot, CPS former CEO Paul Vallis, Gary McCarthy, Willie Wilson, Neil Salas Griffin, Dorothy Brown, Cook County Circuit Clerk Troy LaRavier, the Principals Association, Jamal Green, Black Lives Matter activists, a couple other lesser-known candidates, John Kozlar and Matthew Roney. So we got a big field already. Dorothy Brown has a lot of name recognition. Paul Vallis has held a lot of big positions. So Bridget Gaynor was one name that a lot of people were expecting to get in, the Cook County Commissioner, who grew up on the southwest side, has a north side district, had done a lot of work with the Cook County Land Bank. She literally had all her campaign staff ready, had, from what I could tell, a announcement video ready to go, and then pulled the plug last weekend and decided not to run. So that was a bit of a surprise. Even the Emmanuel advisors were grumbling privately that they hadn't convinced her to not run, and they were, you know, concerned about her cutting into his north side base. So that was a break for Emmanuel, also a bit of a break for Lori Lightfoot, I think. So, Ron, I mean, it's possible someone would get in, but I don't know there'd be a name that would excite you necessarily. I don't think that at this point we're going to see some heavy hitter with huge name ID just come out of thin air.
I don't know who that would be.
Well, you know, Valerie Jarrett's a name that people mention from time to time, but I haven't heard any indication that she's interested in running for mayor. But something like that, you know, an Arne Duncan or something, right? Where somebody, oh, we didn't see that coming. That's a big name. People know that name. But it just doesn't seem likely at this point. I'm sure that's a concern for the Emanuel campaign. His numbers, his popularity is still a big issue, particularly in the African American community. But I think, we're going to see these 10 challengers, and probably there's five who maybe are better known and have a little bit more experience, try to jockey for position, find their lane, and see if they have any money to get their message out. Emanuel's already raised more than $10 million toward his reelection, which is far more than the rest of the field combined.
Well, and as much as the issue of excitement or whatever, I mean, it is August.
Right.
We're also got a gubernatorial election and state election going on, and a lot of the oxygen is kind of getting sucked into that versus the mayoral. The mayoral is still kind of a percolating.
Yeah, I do think, though, come after Labor Day,
sure,
which is typically when people say, oh, that's when the November elections really hit their stride and everybody tunes in. I think we're gonna see the same thing with the mayor's race. I think a lot of people in the city, at least, look at the governor's race and see it as a foregone conclusion. You have a heavily Democratic city, and everybody looks at it and says, J.B. Pritzker's up 20 points. That thing's over. Let's focus on the mayor's race. And there certainly is a lot of that discussion statewide, out in the suburbs. Of course, the fall midterms are a big deal. But inside the city, in these neighborhoods, in these wards, I think once people are done going on their vacations and everyone's back in school and back to work, that race is going to ramp up a lot faster than people think it is.
Well, and it's how it plays in neighborhoods too.
Right.
I mean, that's the way city politics works, and you're I think you're right as far as how city residents feel about the state race for governor, that Chicago's a Democratic town. It's how big does Pritzker win Chicago by, kind
right.
of thing,
right?
And as far as a foregone conclusion, but yeah, it's where these mayoral candidates playing, as you said, finding their lane. And I'm not so sure they've all found a lane.
No, it's early. And I do think that you can watch how they act, and especially Emanuel, to tell whether the campaign season has started. And he hasn't given his big kickoff speech or whatever, but
he hasn't worn a sweater.
He does have his campaign staff, and he did, I think it was CBS, had this fantastic footage, folks should Google it, of the mayor dancing at some CHA housing picnic on, I think, Friday evening. Was it Channel 7?
Yes.
I want to give credit where credit is due. If you watch the mayor's Twitter or Facebook page, if you don't watch it regularly, like I have to, go check it out. But you can see the mayor's out on the weekends. He's at beer festivals. They're taking pictures of him with all these different microbreweries and tagging each brewery in the Facebook photo. In his mind, the campaign is on. He's out there. He's trying to be the everyman. And we'll have to see where all these can. Lori Lightfoot, I think I've seen, again, she's been out at a number of festivals. Paul Vallis. This is a good time of year for people to get out to these block club parties and these
right.
neighborhood festivals and start, trying to figure out what their message is. There's even been a couple of very low-key mayoral forums where, three or four of them have showed up to practice, basically.
No venue too small.
Yeah, right, exactly. So I think Emanuel, running for a third term post Laquan McDonald. Let's not forget the Laquan McDonald, the Jason Van Dyke trial scheduled for September. I mean, that's going to have everybody tuned into city politics as well. So it is going to ramp up in a hurry. I'm not saying it's going to overshadow the governor's race in Chicago, but certainly that is a very dynamic race with a lot of voices, a lot of challengers, and it'll be fascinating to watch how it plays out.
Well, speaking of Laquan McDonald and that police shooting, you have the federal consent decree issues going on involving the city and Lisa Madigan, and even issues still unresolved about issues of, you know, requiring when there is a gun being pointed at somebody. I mean, where are we on this whole idea of the consent decree?
Well, to give the fastest history lesson I can, you know, after Laquan McDonald shooting, U.S. Justice Department does a year-long investigation, and the Chicago Police Department finds all kinds of problems, including a pattern of excessive force and police misconduct. They recommend a federal consent decree, which is when a federal judge oversees all the changes, reforms in the police department.
And the progress.
And the city doesn't comply, there's consequences in court. Emanuel stood up with the Obama Justice Department, agreed to a consent decree. Then Donald Trump comes into office, and Emanuel tries to cut an out-of-court agreement with the Trump administration, which, of course, it was never interested in a consent decree, and also not that interested in constitutional policing as a whole. This document that Emanuel sends as a draft to the Trump administration on police reform is evaluated by Lori Lightfoot, who's now opponent running for mayor, but was his appointee on police reform, a couple different panels. She criticizes it. Emanuel, for several weeks, just kind of tries to duck and hem and haw and says, we don't really have any other route to go on this. And then Lisa Madigan calls it ludicrous for the mayor of Chicago to negotiate with the Trump Justice Department on police reform. A month later, sues the city of Chicago to force a consent decree. Emanuel then agrees to enter negotiations with Madigan on this police reform. So they've had the negotiations. They've released a draft agreement of them. They've agreed on hundreds of areas on how to reform the police department. There's one area they don't agree on, and that is whether when a Chicago police officer points a gun at someone, the police department should record every instance in which that happens. Lisa Madigan thinks it should. It's been included in consent decrees in other places like Baltimore. Emanuel and Police Superintendent Eddie Johnson say not so fast. We're concerned that that requirement may lead officers to hesitate when pulling their gun. Fraternal Order of Police is against the consent decree wholeheartedly. They're certainly against this provision of it. They point to a case where an officer didn't pull her gun and was severely beaten and has some long-term brain injuries as a result. And she reportedly told the police superintendent she was worried about, you know, them becoming the next viral situation. So, you know, the counter argument is a police officer really thinking about having to fill out paperwork when they're in a heat of the moment situation and someone's life is in danger or their own life is in danger and they're pulling a gun? So they're still negotiating that topic and they might have to end up arguing it in court. We'll see. But this whole process is fascinating in terms of the mayoral race because you have Gary McCarthy, former police superintendent, has been very quiet about this, but he said in the past that the Justice Department investigation was a joke. He's not a fan of consent decrees. Paul Vallis has two sons who are cops, a wife who's a former officer. He's like on both sides of the fence on the gun pointing thing and isn't, you know, trying to kind of in some ways have it both ways. You got Lori Lightfoot, who is Emanuel's appointed president of the police board, who's in charge of his police reform task force, saying this consent decree doesn't go far enough. She'd like to see some changes. And you got a whole bunch of other people, you know, somewhere in the middle or haven't been asked yet. So it's going to play out throughout the campaign. It's going to be an issue. Not only how fair Chicago is policed is going to be an issue because of Laquan McDonald, but also we continue to have fits with, you know, violent crime, 31 shootings last night, two of them fatal. That's par for the course in the summer in Chicago, unfortunately. And while the mayor, his line is that crime is down, homicides are down, that's compared to the last year or two, which have been near record numbers, right, at least since the early 1990s. And that's something you heard Gary McCarthy talk a lot about, because when he was superintendent in 2014, 2015, they did have the lowest homicide rate since the 1960s.
All a lot to look forward to as the race continues to develop. Bill Ruthart, my colleague at Chicago Tribune, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Always a pleasure, Rick. Thanks.